Now, how deep is Augustinianism? Well, I like to say it runs wide and deep in Western Christendom. Roman Catholic thinkers immediately appeal to Augustine. If you've ever read the Proslogion by St. Anselm, or if you've read Summa Contra Gentilis, or the Summa Theologica by Thomas Aquinas, or if you're familiar with Blaise Pascal's writing, the Pensées, all of these Roman Catholics see themselves as in the Augustinian tradition. In fact, I believe both Anselm and Pascal speak very highly of the Confessions. Pascal even said at the end of his life, Pascal lived in the 17th century, he was a scientist, he was a writer, he was an apologist. Pascal contracted stomach cancer, and he got rid of his very large library, and there were only two books that he kept. He kept the Bible and the Confessions. And so Roman Catholic thinkers easily gravitate toward Augustine. I think Augustine's writings reflect a broader and more robust view of grace than even Thomas Aquinas, who I must say I think Protestants at times greatly misunderstand. And there have been some Protestant evangelical writers in the last few decades who have underscored that point. Thomas may be more committed to a grace-oriented theology than some people have given him credit for. Well, Augustine also influenced a whole sort of people coming out of the Reformation, including Martin Luther. Do you remember when Luther was merely a monk? He was part of a community that were called the Augustinians. Now, unfortunately, at that time, that community was not as faithful to Augustine's view of grace, but he was an Augustinian monk, and Luther appealed to Augustine, as did the British thinker and theologian Thomas Cranmer, as did John Calvin. And in fact, I'd like to just take a moment and comment about Calvin's extensive use of Augustine. In the new encyclopedia, Augustine Through the Ages, it's 900 pages. It's an entire encyclopedia about everything about the life of Augustine, written by a Roman Catholic scholar, or I should say edited by a Roman Catholic scholar named Fitzgerald. It says that while John Calvin cites Martin Luther about 100 times in his writing, Calvin references Augustine more than 2,400 times. Now, it's pretty easy to understand why Calvin would have done that. The magisterial reformers quoted Augustine to show that their teachings were not novel. They were not new. They weren't pulled out of thin air. But they were actually consistent with the best of historic Catholic theology. Richard Muller, who is an outstanding historical theologian, points out in his book that discusses the reformers' use of Augustine that what we have here is, in many ways, the reformers appealing to what they thought was the best in Catholic theology, and that Trent, in certain respects, anathematized part of Catholic theology when it anathematized the thinking of the reformers. Well, as we move to salvation, Augustine is very significant. And of course, here I'm thinking about his controversy with Pelagius. Augustine was an untiring and tenacious defender of Catholic Christianity. His doctrinal apologetic writings in large part ensured that ancient Christianity would remain a biblical religion of divine rescue and would not degenerate into a humanistic religion of self-help salvation. Later in the series, I will compare the thinking and teaching of Pelagius with that of Augustine, and you'll see that in Pelagianism and Augustinianism, you have two completely different versions of what Christianity is to look like. And Augustine is to be given great credit for helping the faith to remain a divine rescue, not merely a salvation by pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. But let's talk a little bit about Augustine's life. First of all, he's named after two Roman emperors. Can you name them? Marcus Aurelius. His first name is Aurelius. Augustinus, Caesar Augustus. And so he's named after two early two probably of the best Roman Caesars. There aren't too many good Roman Caesars. Caesar Augustus is probably one of them. And Marcus Aurelius, of course, was known as a fairly distinguished philosopher in his own right. So Augustine is born Aurelius Augustinus, was born November 13th in 354 AD, and so he's born in late antiquity. He is born about 20 or 30 years after the Council of Nicaea in a little city called Tagaste. It's a small province in Numidia in North Africa, present-day Algeria. And there's a couple things about North Africa that I find very interesting. Of course, this is that desert region of Africa, but very important in terms of the world coming together. If you think in terms of geography in your mind, you've got Europe up here, you've got Asia over there, the Mediterranean splits Europe, of course, from Africa. And this is where those three continents come together. The North Africans, through their great city of Carthage, were well known because they were a great military sea force that had defeated the Romans at one stage. But one thing I wanted to share with you about North Africa, and particularly where Augustine lived, is this is an extraordinary place in terms of climate. My father fought in North Africa during the Second World War. And I remember when I was a boy, I used to pester my dad to tell me things about the war. One of the things he kept telling me was that when he was in North Africa, he would burn up during the day and freeze at night, literally. There were lots of men who had suffered from trench foot and snow bite. And when I later on went to college, my geography professor said that it's common to have a temperature change from day to night of more than 100 degrees. So you could have 125 degrees during the day, and it may drop down to below 25 degrees at night. So this is quite a challenging place to live. By the way, this is also a place in which Dwight David Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, met with some of the other generals during World War II. And they stayed not too far from that little city called Tagaste. Well, to know something about Augustine is to know something, I think, about his parents. His parents have quite an influence on him. His father, a man named Patricius, was a pagan, was not a Christian. His mother, Monica, Roman Catholics, of course, refer to her as Saint Monica. Monica has a big influence on her son. We might say Augustine was a mama's boy, but there isn't anything necessarily wrong with that. Some of the great Christian philosophers have had intimate relationships with their mother, and Monica has an enduring influence. His parents, I think, would rightly be called kind of a middle-class, maybe lower-middle-class family. What distinguished them, however, was that they were landowners during that particular time. Now, let me say something about his parents. Augustine always said that his father seemed to care more about his education than he did about his character. Now, that's probably both good and bad. I'm sure if you ask my father, who grew up during the Depression, in 1929 when the stock market crashed, my father was 11 years old. In 1939 when World War II broke out, my father was 21 years old. I think if I would have said to my dad, you know, Dad, you love me, I think his response would be, do I get up and go to work in the morning? Do you have a roof over your head? Where'd you get the clothes on your back? I could almost quote my father saying that. Of course, the question I have as I've become a father is that's very significant. There are lots of men who don't support their families. But is providing food, shelter, and clothing for your children enough as a father? Well, I would say it's very significant, but it's not enough. Is even instilling the importance of education and a work ethic in your child enough as a dad? Well, I'm sure many of us would wish we could have done more to instill work ethics in our children, but I would say as important as that is, no, it's not enough. As fathers, we need to teach our children about some of the great things of life, the big questions of life. life's meaning and purpose. And of course, as Christians, our faith in Jesus Christ. And so Augustine, I think, drew benefits because his father encouraged him to study and immediately recognized that his son had significant cerebral ability. But it was left up to his mother to teach him, to catechize him, to talk about the Christian doctrines and values. And I don't want to overstate that. I don't think Augustine had a terribly clear understanding of Christianity when he was a young man. But something that his mother taught him stuck. And he never was really able to get away from the idea that Jesus Christ was an incredibly important figure for him and in the world. Now, one really nice thing about reading the Confessions is that you get to hear Augustine talk about himself. And he mentions that he was not immediately a studious child. In fact, he mentions that when he didn't do his homework, he used to be beaten at school. I asked my son what he thought about that idea. And Augustine didn't think it was a good idea. He didn't think beating people was a good way to encourage them. In fact, he talked about the idea of teachers encouraging their students to have self-discovery. But he also talked about playing ball, that he liked to play ball. Now, I don't know what kind of ball they played in late antiquity. But he talked about the enjoyment of being a child. And by the way, he talks in the Confessions a lot about how children learn and how language is expressed. And Wittgenstein, the 20th century linguistic or analytical philosopher, begins his discussion of language with the Confessions. The Confessions, in some respects, are kind of the first book in antiquity that kind of explores this issue of the self and the motives and things of that nature. Well, Augustine's educated in Tagaste in nearby Madura, but he's educated especially in rhetoric, which is the persuasive use of language. And he becomes a scholar, really, with Latin literature. And so, again, Augustine is not formally trained in theology initially or in philosophy, but he's trained in the classical fields. And if you don't mind me saying, I think this is an area that we often neglect as we think about being articulate spokespersons for the person of Christ and for Christianity. I mean, Pastor Ritterbacher talked about Francis Schaeffer. What kind of books sell today? You know, when you go to the apologetic section of your bookstore, if they have an apologetic section in the bookstore, whose books sell? Well, I think Pastor Ritterbacher is right. It's principally two people whose books really dominate when it comes to apologetics. It's Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis. Now, Lewis, in some respects, reminds me of Augustine. He's really a scholar of literature. But I think Lewis's books and Schaeffer's books have stood the test of the 20th century and into the 21st century because they're such good communicators. They know how to turn a phrase. They know how to reach back into ancient medieval literature and communicate ideas. Well, Augustine was essentially a classical scholar who had mastered the skill of rhetoric and who knew inside and out the writings of the ancient Latin authors. Augustine describes the way he learned. He says that he learned to read by studying the Roman poet Virgil, 70 to 19 BC. And he learned to speak well by studying the Roman orator and politician Cicero. Well, we might say here that Augustine is learning in that classical way, that you identify these great books of literature, you study them, you reflect upon them, you refine your skills based upon these kind of classical categories or standards. Though he was acquainted with Greek and could read Greek and could write in Greek, he preferred the Latin Virgil over the Greek Homer. And for those of you who are interested in the theology of Augustine, you will know that this preference of Augustine for Latin over Greek will later impact his understanding of the doctrine of justification by faith. Later on, when Augustine begins to sort out the meaning of words like justificare, Latin for justification, it has a very different sense than dikaiō and dikaisune in the Greek. In fact, the Latin conveys essentially to make righteous. The Greek conveys the idea of a declaration of righteousness. Now, personally, I don't think Augustine's view of justification or grace really matches with the Tridentine Council. I think Augustine's view is much more broadly grace-oriented. But I have to tell you that Augustine's understanding of justification is not nearly as fine-tuned as that of Luther and John Calvin. And part of it is, again, he is reading a Latin version of the Scriptures. He is influenced by his friend and associate Jerome in reading the Latin. He studies in Carthage, again, the big city, North African capital, and when he goes there for what would be equivalent to his college studies, it's that big city, that pagan environment. Remember, nobody ruled the world like the Romans. And that empire extended not only into Europe, all the way over into Great Britain, but it extended over into Asia Minor and all the way down into North Africa. And Augustine goes to this big city, this pagan environment, and his morals are not very secure, and he becomes detached, really, from the value system and the doctrinal system that he was taught as a boy, as a child. He embraces hedonism. I've known quite a few young people who came from Christian homes who go away to college and embrace hedonism. Hedonism is the idea that pleasure is the greatest goal of life. Of course, hedonism comes in a variety of versions. Some versions place greater emphasis upon the intellectual virtues. The question was asked of John Stuart Mill, would you rather be a dissatisfied Socrates or a satisfied pig? Well, there are some times when I drive home after a long day and I think, I don't know, those pigs look pretty happy in the mud over there. And I seem rather divided on my various ideas. But hedonism can also come in very crass forms. And in this ancient city of Carthage, Augustine saw a lot of hedonism. The public baths, public sexuality, lots of prostitution, and essentially Augustine embraced hedonism at this point. He kind of forgot about some of the virtues that his mother Monica had taught him. In fact, in the Confessions, he says, quote, I went to Carthage where I found myself in the midst of a hissing cauldron of lust. I don't know about you, I've seen some of these studies about college life. A lot of lust that goes on during that particular time. And Augustine just shifted gears and went right into a life of promiscuity and enjoyed all of these types of things that he thought were quite appealing to his human nature. At 17 years old, he took a mistress with whom he cohabitated 14 years. That, of course, tells you that this really wasn't quite the relationship that lots of people at the time were having. He really loved this woman. She was his common law wife. They did, however, have a child. In my day, they'd say they shacked up together, and they had a child, Adeodatus, who Augustine loved passionately, who, by the way, was baptized the same day that Augustine was baptized, who unfortunately died at about 17 or 18 years old. Now, Augustine was promiscuous. In fact, he was so promiscuous that when he became a Christian, he found it very difficult to think that married couples could make love to the glory of God. In Augustine's mind, I think the idea was sex is just far too pleasurable to be pleasing to God. There must be something wrong with it. But you know, that's often the way when people are engaged in sex before their marriage. They often find it very difficult to cope and to enjoy sexuality, and something like that was true of Augustine. But he loved this woman. He never mentions her name. And they break up years later after he becomes a Christian. But really, she's his common law wife in many respects. Now, let's talk a little bit about how Augustine became interested in philosophy. Though he's a rhetorician, he's a man of letters by training. He falls in love with the concept of wisdom by reading the work of Cicero. Cicero's book, The Hortensius, has been lost in antiquity. There are a number of books that were lost in antiquity, and the only thing we know about them are the quotations that come from various people. But Augustine, notice how he describes wisdom here. He's influenced by Cicero. He says, quote, "To love wisdom itself, whatever it might be, and to search for it, to pursue it, to hold it, and to embrace it firmly." As I was reading that passage this afternoon, I was thinking Augustine talks about wisdom as a man would speak of a woman. In fact, when I listen to popular music, and I grew up listening to popular music and still like some of it, particularly the 1960s variety, I hear people talk about relationships. And they talk about them in terms that are very foreign to me. They talk about a woman saving you, or a woman or a man rescuing you. Well, those terms for me are isolated to my relationship with God. But again, if people have kind of been cut off from that, then these relationships become very significant to them. So Augustine here is, again, deeply influenced by Cicero. And Cicero makes no mention of Christ, but Augustine knows about Christ. And he wants to know, is there a way to kind of bring the best of Catholic Christianity with the best of classical writings? But he does a little comparison here. He compares the writings of Cicero with the New Testament. And he has some very interesting things to say about how disappointed he is when it comes to the Scriptures. This, of course, is very strange many years later, the way Augustine will talk about Scripture, because years later he will say this is the definitive book. But at this time he has an interesting quotation. He asserts, "To me, the Scriptures, seem quite unworthy of comparison with the stately prose of Cicero." I think we can safely conclude at this point that Augustine has detached himself from the moral value system he was taught as a child by his mother, and has also left any kind of theological commitment to Christianity. Now, as we move ahead, he's still very religious. Remember what G.K. Chesterton says. When you stop believing in the God of the Bible, you don't stop believing in everything. You start to believe in almost anything. As I read Paul in Romans 1, I would describe what Paul is saying there as a great conflict that goes in the hearts of human beings. They want God and disdain God all at the same time, and this creates a lot of tension. Well, Augustine began looking for an alternative to Catholic Christianity, which he saw as based upon faith, not based upon reason. And he turns to a religious sect, we might call it a cult, called Manichaeanism. And this group tries to synthesize, again, some restored form of Christianity with a classical view of Roman wisdom. And, of course, the Manichaeans were introduced by a Persian thinker named Mani, who, by the way, was executed. He was a martyr because he claimed to be the Paraclete. In those days, you didn't make claims like that easily. You could find yourself in hot water, and Mani ultimately had his life end because of some of the religious things that he said. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these ideas. Because quite frankly, it is some of these Manichaean ideas that impact Augustine's thinking about Christianity, and he has to overcome some of these things to return to his Christian roots. The Manichaeans, again, based upon Mani, they say that the apostles corrupted the teaching of Christ. Mani's going to restore all of this. This is restorationism. How powerful is restorationism in the history of Christianity? Very significant. Christianity has gone off the deep end. Somebody comes along as a prophet who is going to restore what has fallen, often with a new book, This is pretty similar to what we see in Islam, in Mormonism, in Christian Science, even in the early parts of Seventh-day Adventism, in Mormonism. Well, something similar is going on here, but it's an odd blend of dualism and materialism. The world is dominated, say the Manichees, by two co-eternal or opposing principles or gods, and one of them is good and the other one is bad. The good one is called Ormuzd. His description is that he is a deity of light and benevolence. He's the source of good in the world. So if you look around the world and you see good, well, you can connect it to Ormuzd. Ahriman, on the other hand, is described as darkness and malevolence, the source of evil in the world. How many of you have done any reading or thinking about Zoroastrianism? Well, if you have, you notice that there is some connection here. And of course, if we're correct in understanding that Manichaeanism came out of Persia, when you read Zoroastrian writings, the prophet Zoroaster, they also have kind of this dualistic idea, these two deities kind of coming out and dictating the world, creating a world of strife. So there's a clash, a cosmic clash taking place on earth, and you have to decide which side you're going to stand in. Well, to finish off some beliefs here, they were also materialistic. The soul was made of matter, but the soul was made of a lighter matter than the body. The body was a coarse or dark or evil matter. Form of matter. Again, the apostles corrupted the teaching of Christ. Manny comes along to restore those teachings, and they practiced asceticism, a type of self-denial. If you were one of the elect, and I hope you are one of the elect, but elect of a different kind, if you were one of the elect, you couldn't engage in sexuality, you couldn't engage in sexual intercourse, and you couldn't eat meat. Augustine was never one of the elect. He was only a hearer. And, you know, what is interesting here is that the Manichees have certain parallel with the Gnostics and with the Docetists. Like the Gnostics, the Manichees believed that Christ was solely spiritual. He had no material body. They even believed that he didn't die on the cross. And if you were a Manichee, you were not only opposed to Christianity, but Augustine kind of found a certain satisfaction in all of this because, frankly, he's still troubled with his promiscuous lifestyle, and he could just simply say, well, you know, I'm just part of this kind of fatalistic system, and if you were a hearer, sexuality was okay because it really didn't have any significant consequence. Well, as we continue, we notice that this creates certain tensions in the mind of Augustine. As a Manichee, he had three basic problems with Christianity. The first problem that he had was this materialism prevented him from conceiving of God as an immaterial or an incorporeal transcendent reality, which was imperceptible to the senses. God, of course, the God of the Bible, is an infinite, eternal, tripersonal spirit, and you can't see him. Well, the Manichees thought everything was physical, and he had found it very difficult to conceive that God would be transcendent, spiritual, immaterial. A second problem he had is with the problem of evil. Now, I don't know how much of Augustine you've read. I think Augustine has deep insight about the problem of evil. In fact, I think he comes up with some of the best responses to the problem of theodicy. Again, theodicy is the idea of what do we do with evil in a good world made by God? Well, Augustine had questions about the problem of evil, especially evil's relationship to God. He says in the Confessions, where then is evil? What is its origin? How did it steal into the world? Where then does evil come from if God made all things and because he is good, made them good too? Later on, he is going to talk about evil being a privation of goodness. Now, many people have kind of criticized him and said, well, the Bible has more of a robust view of sin than merely a privation of goodness. But nevertheless, I think Augustine really is on to something very insightful here. Years later, he will say that evil is like a parasite that lives on goodness. As Alvin Plantico would say, he used to find it difficult to sleep at night. He'd wake up and wonder why there was evil in the world. I think many of us who are philosophically inclined have that problem. And then Plantica reminded himself that there has to be a standard of goodness to exist in order for evil to transgress it. Well, that whole tradition, I think, really goes all the way back to Augustine here. In many ways, Augustine spends a lot of his apologetic life responding to challenges that he at one time wrestled with or believed or had to repudiate when he became Christian. In Augustine's mind, Manichaeanism provided a better explanation of the problem of evil through its dualism. Strife caused by opposing forces. The good is caused by the good God, the bad by the bad God. Augustine thought, probably, I don't have to engage in kind of an incoherent idea where God is good and all-powerful and yet evil exists. I think Augustine, even in his time, sensed what David Hume would later call this inconsistent triad. How, if God is all-powerful, he could get rid of evil. If he's all-loving, he would, yet evil's still present. So Augustine thought, Manichaeanism has its problems, but it's better than Catholic Christianity. Now, a third objection that he'll have to overcome is that he believes while Christianity is based on faith, and I might say he doesn't think Christianity has a rational foundation. I will say next week, Augustine never meets a robust Christian intellectual until he bumps into Ambrose. And he meets a man named Victorinus, who is a translator of Platonic literature, and he says, wow, I never knew that you could be a Christian and be an intellectual. And then, of course, he meets Ambrose, and Ambrose is celibate. And he says, a man who is that intellectual and can control his sexuality, and he's very impressed by all of that. So Augustine thinks Christianity is based on faith. Manichaeanism is based on reason. Thus, it can give you the truth. And of course, Augustine, as a philosopher, is pursuing truth. That's his main objective. So I think at this point we can conclude that Augustine has some deep misconceptions about the nature of Christianity. Alistair McGrath has written in one of his books that maybe the most important thing for a Christian apologist to do is to rescue Christianity from misperception. I can only tell you, as a student of Islam, as a student of Hinduism, as a student of Judaism, I find it often like I'm on the outside of the window looking in, wondering, what is this Shia-Sunni controversy all about? Or why is it that the Hindus view God this way? Or quite frankly, there are times when I'm looking through the Catholic window, figuring, what in the world is going on in the mind of those Roman Catholics? Or better yet, what is Arminianism really about? And I have friends who look at my faith and say the same thing. Like, you really believe that God foreordains all things that come to pass? Well, Augustine is on the outside looking in, can't quite figure it out. And part of his conversion is going to be sorting out these objections that he has about his faith. Now, I mentioned this kind of moral excuse earlier. Manichaean's view of cosmic evil and strife in the world, a type of fatalism, it allows Augustine to justify his own sinful tendencies, particularly those of the sexual variety, because he just says, look, all of this is kind of beyond my control. I really don't have a way of stopping this. And the ancient religious philosophies that viewed the material world as evil, the Gnostics, the Docetists, the Manichees, they would forbid sex, or they would say, it's so insignificant that it really doesn't matter what you do. So Augustine opted for the latter. This kind of justified, it kind of gave him an intellectual excuse to kind of look at things that way. Now, Augustine remains a Manichee for 9 years. His mind is troubled by some of the things that happen in there. He sees an incoherence in Manichaean dualism, but he finds it difficult to come up with an adequate explanation, and he thinks that this religious system doesn't have an adequate explanation for all these things. And in the Confessions, he even meets kind of the Manichaean Bible answer man, if you will, a man named Faustus. Of all names, his name is Faustus. And Augustine is told by many of his Manichee followers, wait till Bishop Faustus comes to town, and he'll answer all of the objections that you have about dualism. Dualism raises all kinds of intellectual difficulties. It's probably why there has never been kind of an absolute polytheism. How can you have multiple gods all vying? You know, if I have more power, I take it from this god, but this god pulls back. Well, Augustine had lots of objections that were of somewhat of a similar nature that he had toward Christianity. But he meets Faustus, and Faustus is kind of like a politician. Faustus is kind of, he has a nice demeanor, but he's not very deep. And by the time Augustine meets Faustus and Faustus can't answer the question, Augustine has decided to move on. That Manichaeanism will never be something that he will have a deep commitment to. But these ideas continue and remain in his mind. While no longer officially within the Manichaean fold, some of their ideas continue to shape his philosophical and religious thinking. For example, he still retained the three aforementioned objections to Christianity. When I worked with Walter Martin, I discovered how difficult it was. Walter, of course, was the original Bible Answer Man, and I have to say, me included, nobody ever did that show as well as Walter did. But Walter showed me how difficult it is to get people out of Jehovah's Witnesses once they've been in, to get people out of Mormonism once they've been in. And of course, these religions have a false gospel. They have a false Christ and a false God. And if you believe in the wrong Christ, you can shipwreck your faith. Well, when I noticed that 70% of Mormons were at one time in an evangelical church, what was going on in those evangelical churches that people would end up in Mormonism? Maybe the same number of percentage of people who are in the Watchtower were once Roman Catholics. Well, whatever differences you may have with the Roman Catholic Church, they do affirm the Nicene Creed, which is a whole lot better than the Apostles of Denial called the Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, what I notice is even if people come out of these groups, they still have kind of fractured views of God and of Christ and of salvation. Well, this happened to Augustine. He kind of can't really get away from the things that he has experienced in the Manichaeans. So he makes a shift at this point. Remember, Augustine is a very bright fellow. He is a very gifted individual. He's a gifted rhetorician. And so he decides to open a school in Tagaste. And then later he opens a school in Carthage and he decides, you know, I can make money this way. I can have influence this way. But he decided to leave Carthage because the students there were ill-mannered and difficult to control. Oh, how things never really change. And because he hopes for greater career success in the eternal city in Rome. So he moves his school from Carthage to Rome. But when he gets to Rome, he discovers that there are also problems connected with this idea. And let's see here. Have I skipped one there? There we go. Now we are. Well, Augustine believed that he was a man of immense talent. By the way, I think if you met Augustine and Pelagius, you'd like Pelagius more. Augustine was cocky. He was arrogant. He believed that he had immense talent. With his deep ambition, he could aspire to greatness and possibly reach the upper echelon of Rome's power structure. So he opens a school of rhetoric in Rome. And the Romans are not difficult to teach, but they have a bad habit. They don't pay their tuition. By the way, that's why we get your money before you come to the academy, right? Or at least we should. So he has a problem here. They won't pay their, they'll go to the classes, and then right before they're supposed to pay their tuition, they pop out the back door. And that's a problem when it comes to your business relationships. Augustine then, after coming to Rome at only 30 years old, he receives kind of the appointment of a lifetime. He's named Municipal Professor of Rhetoric in Milan. And if you know something about the ancient Roman world, really the most intellectual side of the Roman world was in Milan. His new position offered him notable prestige and influence. He's got lots of money. He's got so much money at this point that a lot of his friends are living with him, kind of in a community housing, if you will. And he has all the benefits of career success, and frankly, the future for him looks really bright. So all the things he ever really wanted at life, he has now kind of achieved. In fact, there's discussion that he may become an advisor for the Roman emperor himself. So he's kind of living large at this point of his life. But those of us who have a conscience, those of us who ask the big question, even though Augustine's career was definitely on the fast track, he still longed for some kind of inward and ultimate truth. He wondered if there was a philosophy of life that could provide his restless heart with an authentic meaning, purpose, and significance. You know, I'm a student of popular culture because I want to reach people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't want to just talk to academics. I want to talk to real people. And what I discover is that we kind of live in a weird world right now. There are young people who just want to be famous. They don't care what it's for. They just want to be famous. I mean, I feel bad that Anna Nicole Smith died. But I wondered, what did this woman ever do with her life? Why is she so famous? For doing what? We have lots of kind of people like that. And frankly, you know, money doesn't buy happiness. I was a Beatle fan since the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. I read an 800-page biography about John Lennon. Not Vladimir Lenin, but John Lennon. And Lennon said in 1965, he said, you know, I'm one of the most well-known men in the world. He said, I have so much money, my grandkids can't spend it all. And he said, I've had sex with women all around the world. And he said, I am completely unhappy. Wow. Wow. You know, I've read a lot of things about a lot of people like that. They have no spiritual resources. They're kind of flapping in the wind. I mean, imagine you and I suspect you're probably a lot like me. You probably thought, you know, if I get the right job, marry the right woman, have the right circumstance, my life can really be happy. Imagine overnight being given everything that you could possibly dream of, and then you say, is this all there is? Pascal in the Pensée says, rich people know what the poor people don't. Money doesn't make you happy. Well, Augustine has a lot of money, and he has a lot of fame and a lot of prestige, but he is not very happy. He's looking for meaning, purpose, and significance. A lot of these people are looking for something significant, but they don't have any spiritual resources. They are not like you and me, who can open up God's word and have God's word change our heart and our being. They don't regularly attend a church where they hear the magnificent message of the gospel week by week. And so they're searching, and they're lonely, and they're empty. Well, Augustine experiences a lot of that. He reflects back on his days of searching, In the Confessions, he says, "Man is one of your creatures, Lord, and his instinct is to praise you. The thought of you stirs him so deeply that he cannot be content unless he praises you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you." Boy, you know, one of the reasons why I really like this book is because when I read it, I really get the impression that Augustine is talking about me. There are some scholars who have said, you know, maybe Augustine was actually a lot more clever than we ever thought. Maybe the Confessions is not about his conversion and his search. He's really writing a book about the heart of humankind. This is all of our search. We're all looking. We're all wondering. We're all restless. What do people really need? To rest in God. To know that God loves them and has forgiven them. To know that their relationship with Him does not depend upon their inadequate moral achievements, but that God really knows us and loves us and cares for us. And this theme is very powerful in Augustine, that we're restless until we rest in God. He goes on to say, "But my sin was this, that I looked for pleasure, beauty, and truth not in Him, but in myself and in His other creatures, and the search led me instead to pain and confusion and error." You know, if you you marry a wonderful woman like the woman I married, a woman who loves you sacrificially, a woman who is utterly committed to you. I remember being in the hospital when I was very sick. Every other hour I'd say to her, "Why am I here?" Because I had brain lesions that didn't allow me to think clearly. But you know, even a spouse who is a great gift from God, they can't save you. No humans can save each other. We can't find truth and meaning and purpose in other creatures. We have to find it in the Creator. And this is very powerful in the writings of Augustine. He goes on to say, "Who will grant me rest? Who will grant me to rest content in you? To whom shall I turn for the gift of you coming into my heart and filling it to the brim?" When I was very young, I had an automobile. It was made by Toyota, one of their first Corollas. Then my father helped me put my money together and buy a Chevrolet. And so I kept the tools from the Toyota, but the Japanese tools of the Toyota wouldn't work on my Chevrolet. They were obsolete. Have you ever seen that Twilight Zone where the man is condemned for being obsolete? No, I'm out of sync. I don't quite know what my purpose is. These are the kind of existential themes written, of course, by people like Kierkegaard and Pascal, but they go back much further into the life of Augustine. Now, in Milan, Augustine's intellectual and existential pilgrimage enters a new phase. You know, he's been disillusioned in his pursuit of hedonism, paganism, Manichaeanism, and even worldly power and intuition. He begins to entertain the notion that ultimate truth might simply be unknowable or unattainable. He enters what I call his postmodern phase. In fact, he begins reading some of the skeptical writers at the academy. Plato must be spinning in the world of forms at this point, because Plato hated skepticism, but the skeptical philosophers have kind of captured the attention at the academy. And Augustine begins reading them, and he, in fact, begins to look at Neoplatonic philosophy, and it is some of these kinds of things that really coalesce to set the stage for his conversion to Christianity. This is a very controversial point, but I actually think Augustine's reflection on Platonism actually helped him return to Christianity. I'll say more about that next week when we talk about his conversion. But let's take a look at these stages. He starts off with kind of very primitive kind of Christian roots. He moves to hedonism. Pleasure is the greatest goal of life. Embraces kind of a classical paganism, but he doesn't find any of it fulfilling and satisfying. He then moves to cultic religion because he can kind of never get away from that religious impulse. But he finds Manichaeanism to be incoherent and unsatisfactory. He then looks to make a career for himself. Maybe he can take a position in the Roman Empire. But even when he makes lots of money and has lots of fame, that really doesn't do much to fulfill his existential need. So he lands in skepticism. Well, a lot of us have walked down that road. A lot of us have been there. He later says in the Confessions, he says, "For all I want to tell you, Lord." And by the way, when he writes in the Confessions, he writes kind of the way King David does in the Psalms. Augustine's favorite biblical book, at least his favorite Old Testament book, is the Psalms. In fact, when he died, this is jumping ahead a bit, but when he died, he had his servants write the penitential songs on the roof above his deathbed. So he could lay in the bed and pray and communicate and read the Psalms as he passed away. He says, "For all I want to tell you, Lord, is that I do not know where I came from when I was born into this life which leads to death. Or should I say, this death which leads to life." Augustine always has those turns of phrases. You know, I thought about that when I was deathly sick. I thought, you know, maybe life is just an evolutionary luck of the draw. And so I'm born into a life and I'm going to die. And then I turn back and say, no, maybe I'm born into a death that will ultimately lead to life. And that, of course, is the difference of the gospel, that we all are going to die, but the Lord gives us life. He says, "I turned away from you. I turned away from you, whom alone I should have sought, and lost myself instead on many a different quest." Well, next week we're going to look at Augustine's conversion. In fact, I'm going to isolate 6 apologetic factors that led to his conversion to Christianity. And I'm going to argue that in many respects, it's a model that we can use today. Many of the things that led to the conversion of Augustine are things that led to our conversion. And again, we'll look at the Confessions in more depth. That ends my lecture talk. We like to give you lots of opportunities to come up to the microphone and ask a question or make a comment. And we want to get your comments on tape. And I want, as John Warwick Montgomery used to say, I want to look in your beady eyes and judge your motivation. No. I'm a Calvinist who doesn't bite very hard at all. So please feel free to come up and ask a question about the life and thought of Augustine.
What time was Jesus around, and what was the time difference between Augustine and Jesus?
Very good question. Well, Michael, I think most scholars think that Jesus was born somewhere between 6 and 4 B.C. Unfortunately, he wasn't born in the year 1. The calendar probably put Jesus 6 to 4 B.C., and I think most scholars are willing to argue that the time of his crucifixion was likely 30 A.D. So Jesus lives in the first century. He dies in 30 A.D., which then sees his resurrection. Augustine is born almost 350 years later. So Augustine is born in 354, what we call the fourth century, and he dies in 430 A.D., by the way, when he dies, the barbarian German tribes are dominating the Roman Empire. Rome is sacked. Rome is overcome by the Visigoths, these German barbarians, as they were known by the Romans, in 410. And when Augustine died in 430, the Visigoths had gone all the way down to North Africa, and they were ready to smash that whole area and control it. And they didn't burn Augustine's library because they knew of his greatness as a Christian thinker. So we're talking really at the time the Roman Empire is coming apart. Later in the 5th century, the emperor is going to abdicate his throne and the Roman Empire will come to an end. and the medieval period will begin. So Augustine lives about 350 years approximately after the time of Jesus Christ.
You mentioned that Augustine's mom was a Christian. What exposure did Augustine have as a child to the church? You mentioned he was baptized as a child, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. Augustine lived at a time where there was what I think we would call rather an odd practice. They delayed people's baptism. And I suspect that they delayed it because they were afraid people would commit mortal sin. And so if you delayed your baptism to the latest possible moment, maybe you could, be baptized into a state of grace and remain in that context. That kind of shows you the kind of unusual ideas that circulated at that time. I don't know how much significance to put on Monica's teaching of her son. Monica's a remarkable woman. She's very distressed that her boy has left the faith and has shacked up with this woman. And even though he's become kind of this extraordinary intellectual, she's always very troubled that he's left the church. So there are stories that she would go and speak with the bishop and whine and complain and moan. And then finally, the story is that one of the bishops says, "I guarantee your son's going to come back because God cannot put up with all this whining that is going on." I suspect that she probably introduced him in a rudimentary way to Christian ideas. But I will say this, he finds it hard to get away from Jesus. And so there was something significant that she left with her son. He tended to look at her as very sincere, but kind of on the simple side in terms of the intellect. But she had a powerful influence on him, as will other Christian thinkers later on.
I believe you mentioned that a lot of people would like Pelagius better than Augustine. And I interpreted you as implying that Augustine seemed to be full of himself or prideful. If that existed after he became a Christian, then I would consider that somewhat of a contradiction. Could you go into that a little more?
Yeah, I'm being a little... I'm trying to be provocative when I say that. Augustine was very, very bright, and he knew it. And I think he probably was a bit impatient with people who weren't quite as gifted as he was. I'm also really saying something about Pelagius. Pelagius, who, we tie the Pelagian heresy to, which I suspect may be one of the worst heresies in the history of Christianity, maybe worse than Gnosticism, maybe worse than Arianism. Pelagius was a very kind, soft-spoken, very, very devoted type of individual. Augustine always kind of had a bit of a sarcasm. It's wonderful to read the letters between Augustine and Jerome. Augustine's a bit, he has a good wit. He will, he'll write to Jerome and say, "Jerome, you are the world's greatest biblical scholar, and I am just a lowly bishop," And he's sticking the needle in, I think, at various times. I'm sure Augustine was filled up with himself, but I suspect that one of the reasons why he wrote the Confessions is because after he became a Christian, he had such an extraordinary reputation as being such a holy man that he felt like he needed to talk candidly about his own sinfulness. So the truth of the matter is that the grace of God in his life was terribly evident in changing him from a very prideful, worldly individual, really to, at the time of his death, the Christian thinker in the world with probably the greatest reputation. I mean, even the Visigoths said, this is a great man. And many people recognized his brilliance. But, people who are cerebral have to work very hard at humility sometimes. And sometimes the Lord humbles them. But he was filled up with himself, and then when he became a believer, the Lord filled him with himself, is the way I would put it. Can you come to the mic? Are you able to? Go ahead.
Underlining, so that you can follow thought by thought and know exactly where the author is going and where he's been. And yet when I went through Confessions, it was just 500 pages of the same thing, and it was just hard to follow.
Kind of a stream of consciousness, right?
Just the way they wrote it that time?
Yeah, very, very good question. For purposes of the tape, my friend here read the Confessions, and it didn't seem to kind of have the formal structure that is characteristic of other works. It seemed, and I think you and I talked about this prior, that it's kind of like a stream of consciousness. Well, let me say a couple things about it. In one sense, remember, the Confessions is written as a prayer to God. I suspect that if you heard me pray or I heard you pray, it might be very different than me standing up here giving a formal lecture. So the book is really kind of his time of reflection, his own meditations. It's also intended to be written in a way like the book of Psalms, where he's kind of at times crying out to God and at other times very repentant of his views. I think it's also a personal biography. The Confessions really was the first autobiographical book. When you walked into Barnes & Noble in the Roman Empire, there were no autobiographies. There probably were no Barnes & Noble. Maybe there were Cicero and Virgil's at the time. I don't know. But remember the kind of literature that it is. It is very meditative. It is very personal. It is very different, and so it may also be that maybe you haven't read, in my opinion, the best translations or the best version. Pinecoffin's version, in my opinion, is just a lot better than others, because even in the table of contents, he gives you an outline of what's happening in Augustine's life, so you can kind of track with it. And Pinecoffin was a Jesuit, and he, you know, grew up reading these great Catholic thinkers. So I think you're going to get a lot out of it. I will tell you, if I had to go live on a desert island, as Mortimer Adler used to say, imagine going to live on a desert island, you can only take 10 books with you. The Confessions would definitely be one of the 10 books that I would take. I've read it dozens of times. I try to read it at least once a year. I have found it to be deeply enriching. Adler says the characteristic of a great book is that it is able to move you and challenge your thinking, and it keeps on doing that. You know, some books you read and it's like, well, I really wish I hadn't wasted my money on that book. Or some books you read and it's like, I've gotten everything out of that book. When I read the Confessions, I always feel like it leaves me wanting more. I think that's the sign, and I had the great honor. When Adler was near his death, I got to have some interaction with Professor Adler via email. And we went back and forth through an intermediary. And I think that's the sign of a great book. It stands the test of time. And so I want you to give it another shot. R.C. Sproul says that if you've been a Christian more than 2 years and you haven't read the Confessions, you're sinning. And I agree with R.C. on that point. I think it's a marvelous book, and give it another go. I think you're going to get a lot out of it.
Yes, I had a question out of Book 5, Section 2. He says, "I had deserted even my own self. I could not find myself, much less find you, God." Is there a parallel between that and John Calvin's works or words in the Institutes, where he says knowledge of God implies knowledge of self as well?
I think so, Alan. I think so. Remember, Calvin would associate himself with the best in Catholic theology, and in his mind, the best is Augustine. And as you rightly alluded to, Calvin's remark about it's only in God that I know myself, this kind of thing makes its way in the Pensées by Pascal. It's only knowing Jesus Christ that I really come to know myself, that my fallen nature is out of sync. And I think you even see this in the book of Genesis. You know, after the fall, Adam's relationship with God has gone wrong. His relationship with Eve has gone wrong. The woman you gave me, you know. And to some extent, even with nature and even within himself. Now, I'm sure some of you don't have great appreciation for existential philosophy. I tend to think that some of these atheists do an incredibly good job of describing the fallen condition. But Christian existential thought did not begin with Kierkegaard, who, by the way, saw himself as a proud Augustinian. I think in many ways it has its roots in Augustine, and it's passed down. And I think Calvin and Augustine on that point would agree. When I come to know God, I not only know God through Christ, but I then become to know who I am and my fallen condition. So, yes, I agree.
You mentioned that the Confessions was probably the first autobiographical book in that time. Was it meant to be read by the public? Was that something that he wrote thinking that it was never to be read by anyone, and that as time went on, we just turned it into an autobiographical book, especially being so personal, some of the things he went through? Or was it something he actually wrote thinking that at one day somebody, it was going to be meant to be read?
Great question, David. Well, Pine Coffin says that Augustine was a great sinner who became a great saint. And one of the motivations, according to Pine Coffin, was that people kind of looked at him in such reverent terms that he felt in order to convey the depth of God's grace, he needed to really be candid about his own foibles. And when you read the Confessions, you really do get that sense. I mean, there's a story early on in Book One where Augustine and his, we might say, his posse, his homeboys, if you will, in Tagaste, they break into this person's property and they steal all the pears. And he says, we didn't do it because we were hungry or we needed it. You know, we're a middle class kind of folk. We did it because it was forbidden, right? You ever met teenagers like that who just want to do something because, you know, I do what I'm told not to do? Well, Augustine then says, what is it about our human nature that we kind of relish in doing the things that we're told not to do? So I think part of it was for him to be very candid. The term confessions, I think, can be used in a triple sense. It's his confession of his sins. It's his confessions of his newfound faith. You know, we confess the creed. And then it's his confession of the greatness of God. So who was his... Who was he writing to? I think he was writing to the contemporary Christians of the time. And I think he also wanted to write a book like the Psalms. By the way, Calvin loved the book of Psalms, as did Luther. What is it about the book of Psalms? I suspect maybe part of it is it puts truth about God in a poetic form that just reaches out and grabs you. This idea of reading the Psalms on your deathbed, that to me warms my heart that Augustine saw that. So I think he wrote it to the people. He became Bishop of Hippo, which was a large region. And I think he wrote it for himself. People ask me, who are you writing to? I often say, I'm writing because I have something to say. I think Augustine often felt he had something to say. Anybody else? Jump up there. This is your opportunity.
Ken, you said that all of Christendom adopts Augustine except Eastern Orthodox. My question is, what's the view of Augustine in Arminianism, particularly since the Reformers relied so much on Augustine?
Yeah, that's That's a good point, Jeff. And I wouldn't say that even the Eastern Orthodox are put off by Augustine, but the point I'm making there is again, as I study Eastern Orthodoxy, and again, if I can reference or allude to the McGrath quote, I often feel like I'm peeking through a window trying to figure out what is Eastern Orthodoxy about. You know, they don't talk my language, so to speak. They don't talk about the language of a courtroom when it comes to salvation, of acquittal, and a declaration of forgiveness. At least Catholics and Protestants kind of speak the same language. We just disagree about how to parse it and how to understand it. You know, the Orthodox talk about becoming little gods. They talk about more of a mystical orientation. So they like the Eastern Fathers. They're more proud of Athanasius and the Fathers of the East than they are of Augustine. They see Augustine more as the Western Father. In terms of Arminianism, and I have some Arminian friends joining us, and I want to say how much I appreciate them coming to the Academy. I think that they like Augustine for a variety of reasons. I think they like Augustine in terms of here is a person who is very passionate intellectually, but also in terms of his life. Benedict XVI, the present pope, said that he preferred Augustine over Thomas Aquinas. That's quite a statement for a Roman Catholic pope to say that. And he said, because when I read Thomas, Thomas is very abstract, very analytical. He's almost an analytical philosopher, even though he's a medieval thinker rather than the 20th century analytical thinker. Augustine writes more about his life. It's more existential in orientation. And I think there are other branches of Christendom that appreciate that about him. They appreciate that when Augustine thinks and writes, it's never separated from his life. So Augustine, I think, is a universal Christian voice in many respects, maybe as close as we can ever get, with Lewis being a close second. And maybe the New Testament really being the only one. But I think Arminians overall like him. They may not like his views on predestination, however. Anybody else? We'll take one more after him. So somebody get in line, then we're going to close it off.
Yeah, I'm going to ask this question more to see how you respond to it than the question itself. If Augustine was such a great Christian thinker, or such a great thinker, then why did he spend 9 years being in Manichaeism and more in Neoplatonism if he was such a great thinker?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think because to have a high view of grace, well, let me put it the other way around. When I study Christian theology, it seems like when I look at the history of the Christian faith, those traditions that have a high view of sin have a higher view of grace. And those traditions that have a low view of sin have a low view of grace. I think what we find in the life and the mind of Augustine is that conversion to Christianity is not a matter of how intelligent you are. It's not merely a cerebral content. Smart people are not more advantaged than other people that aren't in Mensa or don't score as high on IQ tests. I meet people all the time, and they just seem to kind of have an intuitive faith. My wife is like that. You know, I talk to her and say, well, what do you think about Plantica's revision of the ontological argument? She says, I just want to go out and look at the sunset. That tells me there's a God. We were walking around a track and a bird landed. She goes, wow, what a wonderful bird that the Lord has put right there. Wow. I wish there was a simplicity at times to my own faith. I wish I had that kind of side that I see in other people. I think in some respects, Augustine was a twisted soul. And it also shows the power of these counterfeit philosophies. They filled him. They twisted him. And I think he was illustrating what Paul says in Romans 1. He didn't want God. He didn't want to be holy. He even later said, "Lord, give me chastity, but not yet." I think Augustine is refreshing in that sense, in that he was tied up. And I don't think we should think that Manichaeanism, even though it maybe in some respects was kind of a weird sect, it did hold him. Now, with Platonism, now, Pastor Ritterbogger might take a different view than I do. I tend to think that Plato is the great genius of Western philosophy. And I tend to gravitate toward more of a Platonic philosophical scheme. So I think Platonism actually helped Augustine in some respects. Now, I'll talk about that next week, and we can debate it, you know, as to what it was. But your very good question, I think the answer to your very good question is that, frankly, Augustine was caught in sin. That sin is something that has got us by the core of our being. And the difference in him is he's perfectly candid about how totally inept he was, how totally unable he was to change that orientation. I guess I must add one other point, and I would encourage you to give consideration to this when you hear my lectures. I have been told that I have an idealistic view of Augustine. And that probably is true. But I can only tell you that reading him is like having a soulmate. He speaks to me in a way because his theology and his philosophy come together in such a way that gives me such encouragement. And other people find it in Luther, in Calvin, in others. Augustine's just very special. In fact, my son here, his name is Michael Augustine Samples. When Kim baptized him, he says, "I baptized Augustine." So, well, let's close. Next week, talk about the conversion. I hope you will all come back, because Augustine's conversion is very powerful. And the apologetic things that come in, you can really see God's powerful grace. But let's close. You can hang around and talk to people here. We like to have the academy because we like to give people a forum who can talk to other people who like theology, who like apologetics, who are interested in philosophy. You can get to know people. I don't want you to fail to appreciate the really helpful books that we're offering in this class. Candidly, if I had to go live on a desert island, my Bible would be the first book I'd take. The Confessions would be number two. And Peter Brown's discussion of Augustine, Brown understands Augustine like very few people. So these are really excellent books that can help you as you think about many of the things that we're going to be talking to. And if you'd like to ask me questions afterwards, feel free to come up. I'd be happy to do that. Let's close our time formally with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, when we look at the life of Augustine, we are reminded of how wonderful your grace is, how loving and caring you are, that you have a meaning and purpose for our life. Lord, that you forgive sinners. The message of your book, the Bible, is that you forgive sinners. And Lord, we are encouraged, and we receive deep insight when we realize that your hand has been behind the Christian church for two millennia, that you call people to faith, that your gospel is as powerful today as it was the day that our Lord rose from the dead. And Lord, I know that there are young people here who can be called to a life of service to you. And in fact, all of us are called to a life of service. The Christian life is not a life for just the priests. It is a life that you call all of us to, a life of thought, a life of service, a life of grace. And we ask, Lord, that you would continue in this series to teach us through your word and through the writings of your great saints and your great church fathers. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.